In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I have to say, I know at the beginning of every episode, I say how thrilled I am and how amazing an episode we have, but I really, really am thrilled this time because, as listeners will know, ever since I read Jason Fung's book, The Obesity Code, I have been really taken with intermittent fasting and very interested in how it works and the potential health benefits. And then, recently, I opened the New England Journal, and there is an article about intermittent fasting, reviewing the evidence for the benefits of it by Dr. Mark Mattson as the senior author. And I thought, oh, I have to try to get him on the show. And I'm so grateful that he has agreed to come on. Dr. Mattson is a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins and really one of the world experts on intermittent fasting. And I'm thrilled to have him here to talk about it. And we'll talk about it kind of in general and then also about some perioperative implications of this. Dr. Mattson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, Jed, I'm happy to converse with you today, and I'm looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Awesome. All right. Well, let me start by just going very basic here. You've been really interested in this for a long time, but let me just ask about you. So tell us a little bit about kind of who you are, what you do, and how this became an interest for you.
I'm trained as a neuroscientist. And I was a lab chief at the National Institute on Aging for 20 years. And, of course, there our work was mainly focused around brain aging, age-related neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. And as part of that, we did a lot of fundamental work at the cellular molecular level. On the one hand, trying to understand what happens during normal aging, what goes wrong in these neurodegenerative disorders, and on the other hand, trying to understand what signaling mechanisms might protect the brain against these adversities of aging.
Yeah, so, and that kind of got you interested in looking at this.
Yeah, it's been known for a long time that daily calorie restriction will extend lifespan in rats and mice, so it has kind of an anti-aging effect, if you will. And turns out the way most of the studies are done with daily calorie restriction is such that the animals are given all their food in one allotment each day, and when that amount of food is, say, 30 to 40% less than they'd normally eat, if they could eat as much as they want. It turns out the animals eat all of their food within a 4 to 6 hour time window. So they're actually fasting for 18 to 20 hours every day. And back in the 1990s, and I should also say, a colleague of mine at the NIA, he's retired as well, Don Ingram, had shown in the 80s that every other day fasting in rats and mice extends their lifespan by up to 80%. And so in the 90s, we got interested in this from the standpoint of brain aging. We asked a simple question: if we maintain rats or mice on an intermittent fasting feeding schedule, will it protect nerve cells in experimental models that are relevant to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, as well as acute brain injuries such as stroke?
Right. And so, you know, what a fascinating area of research. Well, let's get back to that in a minute. Let me ask you from a kind of very basic standpoint, what when we say intermittent fasting, what does that mean? Is there a specific definition? What does it mean to you?
Intermittent fasting is an eating pattern. It's not a diet. It's an eating pattern in which there's time periods with no calorie intake sufficient to deplete energy stores in the liver, which is essentially glucose, and then tap into the fat stores. The fatty acids are released from those cells into the blood. They go into the liver, and they're converted to ketones. So intermittent fasting is an eating pattern in which there are periods where this metabolic switch occurs, and that can be detected, say, clinically by simply taking blood and measuring ketone levels.
Okay, so if you're not eating for long enough to produce ketones, then that's a pretty reasonable definition of a fast.
That's right. And that typically in a person just during normal daily activities takes at least 10 to 12 hours to deplete the liver energy stores. The liver typically has about 600 to 700 calories worth of energy. And of course, if you exercise, then that's going to deplete the liver stores more quickly, and the metabolic switch will occur more quickly.
Okay, right. And so when people run a marathon and they, you know, quote unquote, hit the wall, part of that is depleting their glycogen stores in their liver. And that, of course, is happening within, you know, a couple of hours of running a marathon because you're using those calories very quickly. Is that right?
That's right. And in fact, there's a lot of interest now among endurance athletes in starting an event in the fasted ketogenic state so that this down period of performance, hitting the wall, as you say, doesn't occur.
Interesting. So if you're already burning ketones and doing that efficiently, then you don't need to worry about your glycogen running out because you're not relying on it anyway.
That's right. And from an evolutionary perspective, this all makes a lot of sense in with regards to animals in the wild, including humans, hunter-gatherers. So they don't wake up after sleeping and food is waiting for them. So they have to work for the food, both cognitively. Their brain has to be able to figure out, you know, make decisions on where to go, what kind of food source they want to tap into, and then they have to expend a lot of energy. So from an evolutionary perspective, it's natural to expend a lot of physical energy in the fasted state.
Right. And, you know, speaking of historical perspectives, I mean, you know, it does seem to make a lot of sense, first of all, that for most of our, I mean, the vast, vast majority of our history, we were not doing what we do now. And you bring this up in your article that, you know, what the majority of Americans and probably much wider than just America, but are doing is eating pretty much constantly. So 3 meals a day, snacks in between, a midnight snack, an early morning donut. There's very few hours without food going in. People sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and go grab a bite and then try to go back to sleep. So, you know, some people probably aren't going more than 3 or 4 hours ever without food. And that is very different than how we evolved. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And also, if you think about it, well, what I want to talk about, if we get time, is what's happening at the level of organs and cells in response to switching back and forth between a fasting period, a ketogenic state, and then back to a fed state, and how the switching back and forth may optimize health and protect cells against injury and disease. And when we get to talking about, for example, surgery and you know, trauma, what I want to talk about is that it takes a while for the system to adapt to intermittent fasting, and it's kind of like a preconditioning effect, which I think most of your listeners will be familiar with, where if you expose a tissue to a mild stress, then they will become more resistant with, you know, repeated low exposure to stress to more severe stress. And that's right. Essentially what intermittent fasting do. It's a kind of a moderate level of preconditioning.
Okay, so you're putting your body and cells and system under stress of not having glucose and having to adapt to using ketones, and then that you know, not only makes it easier the next time, but also has a variety of downstream effects that carry over into the non-fasting state.
That's right.
Great. So, you know, let's maybe since it came up, let's just talk about that a little. Do you want to say a few words about, you know, those effects on a cellular level? What is happening? Why is it beneficial for us to have this switch back and forth, and therefore, you know, less beneficial or detrimental to be constantly using glucose and never using ketones?
Okay, I'll start with the fact that during fasting, cells will reduce their protein synthesis. And there's a pathway called the mTOR, M-T-O-R, target of rapamycin pathway, which is kind of a master regulator of protein synthesis. During fasting, the mTOR pathway is reduced, and overall protein synthesis goes down. However, the cells can still upregulate expression of proteins that are critical for their stress resistance and being able to endure this bioenergetic challenge. And associated with downregulation of mTOR is upregulation of autophagy, which is essentially a mechanism whereby the cell recycles usually damaged proteins, dysfunctional mitochondria. So it's conserving components, recycling amino acids. And so during the fasting, the cell goes into a stress resistance mode, kind of a non-growth mode. Then during the recovery period, after eating, mTOR pathway is activated, amino acids are taken up, proteins are synthesized, and cells can then grow and repair any damage that's occurred. So this is kind of the general notion. There's a lot more complexity to it. For example, also activated during the fasting period are antioxidant stress response pathways. For example, one pathway called the NRF2, nuclear regulatory factor 2 pathway. That pathway, when it's active, stimulates the production of a number of different antioxidant enzymes. Also upregulated is DNA repair. My lab showed that a number of years ago. We collaborated with Dr. Will Bohr at the National Institute on Aging, who's an expert on DNA damage and repair. And then there's a strong analogy with the effects of intermittent fasting on cells and the effects of exercise on muscle cells. And so similar to what I just said, with exercise, your muscle cells don't grow in size and get structurally stronger during the exercise. It's during the resting period that happens. During the exercise, it's a stress, actually quite a large stress if you're doing a vigorous workout on muscle cells. And many of these same pathways that I mentioned are activated in muscle cells in response to exercise, as are activated in response to fasting. And then finally, there's another pathway, first discovered in muscle cells. it's activated in response to exercise, and it stimulates the proliferation of mitochondria, the growth and division of mitochondria. It's a process called mitochondrial biogenesis. And so this pathway is controlled by a transcription factor called PGC1-alpha. And it turns out people who studied muscle also found that fasting will upregulate this same pathway. And then during the feeding period, there's a proliferation of mitochondria. So in muscle, in response to exercise, that makes a lot of sense. The exercise will, over time, increase the number of mitochondria in each muscle cell, which then provides more energy for those cells and at least partially contributes to the increased endurance with regular exercise.
Right. That's really interesting. So it makes a ton of sense, as you said, for muscles. If you exercise, then that muscle would want more mitochondria for the next exercise. Why do you think it happens with fasting? What's the reason that fasting would cause muscle cells to produce more mitochondria?
I think we have to think about this again, go back to the evolutionary perspective. So the notion would be that individuals whose brains and bodies function best in the food-deprived state were more successful in acquiring enough food to survive and reproduce and pass their genes on. So perhaps individuals whose cells did not respond to fasting by upregulating these pathways were less successful because they're, and then I'm a neuroscientist, and so most of our work has been on what happens in the brain in response to intermittent fasting as well as exercise. And essentially, the kind of the bottom line is from a number of different studies, for example, manipulating genetically PGC1-alpha, knocking it down in neurons in the brain, and then asking how do the neurons respond to intermittent fasting or activation of some of the pathways that are engaged by intermittent fasting. And so the evidence we have suggests that intermittent fasting will stimulate the formation of new synapses between neurons and can improve learning and memory, not immediately. Interestingly, we find it takes at least 2 to 4 weeks before we can detect these changes. Well, the synaptic changes, some of them occur a little quicker. So what we think is happening is during the fasted state, signaling pathways are activated that then set the cells up to grow better, form new synapses, and function better in the fed state. So again, the switching back and forth seems to enable the cells to enhance their plasticity.
Right. And that, so it's really the intermittent nature of it, which is, as you said, how we evolved as hunter-gatherers, et cetera. So that's great. That's the kind of basic, the science level, what's happening at the cellular level. What about in terms of how that translates to disease? Because you cite all kinds of just fascinating, connections. So that intermittent fasting may help to reduce the risk of cancer, Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, diabetes, and insulin sensitivity, and potentially increase lifespan. So, the way that the cellular changes are translating is potentially having these very significant effects. Do we know, what level of confidence do we have about some of that stuff? Like, do you feel confident saying intermittent fasting is going to reduce your risk of cancer, Alzheimer's disease, et cetera?
No, we can't say for sure yet, but the evidence is getting stronger and stronger. The data from animal studies are strong. And what we can say in humans, there have been scores of studies of intermittent fasting in overweight humans. And pretty much uniformly, what's found is that risk factors for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and stroke, and even cancers are improved in people who are adapted to intermittent fasting. And so these include reduced fasting glucose and insulin levels, reduced circulating markers of inflammation and oxidative stress. There's also improvements in lipid profiles, decreased triglycerides. And then with regards to neurodegenerative disorders, it's weaker. And it's in humans, it's again based on risk factors. There's pretty strong epidemiological evidence now that people who are chronically overweight during their adult life, and particularly those with diabetes, are at increased risk for cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's if they live long enough, if they live into their 70s, for example, and 80s. And then there's also a lot of evidence from animal studies that, and we have various models, we can induce diabetes in animals genetically or through other means, toxins that damage the insulin-producing cells. And in these animal models, cognition is impaired. And in if we, for example, put quote-unquote Alzheimer's mice that get amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary degeneration of neurons in their brains, if we put them on high-fat fructose or sugar diet, then that sort of bad, unhealthy diet will accelerate the brain pathology and accelerate the onset and progression of cognitive impairment.
Okay.
You know, so strong data in animal studies, but that's, of course, a lot of times what pans out in animals, particularly with drug development, doesn't necessarily translate to humans. But I'm pretty confident based on the animal data and human epidemiological data and clinical trials that of intermittent fasting that risk factors for these age-related diseases will be reduced.
Yeah, and you know, what I think is so interesting is that there's, even if the evidence isn't clear-cut, and even if we can't say, you know, you definitely will reduce your risk of cancer or Alzheimer's, et cetera, by doing this, you know, if there's even a chance that you could and there's no harm to it, then why wouldn't you? And I think the answer is a lot of people think that fasting is just not something they can do. I mean, it sounds terrible. Is it not eating, right? I mean, do people get, they say, I get hangry. I can't not eat. But so much of it, and you bring this up in the article, is just about getting used to it. That, you know, if you give your, if you, for example, if you drop breakfast, you're going to be hungry in the morning for a little while. But, you know, I've been doing this now for at least a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years. And, you know, I don't get hungry in the morning anymore, right? But of course I did when I, the day after I stopped eating breakfast. So, you know, it's very doable if you kind of get over that hump. So I think that people are way more intimidated by the idea of doing intermittent fasting, kind of inappropriately so, because once you do it, you find actually it's very easy to do.
Yes, that's exactly right. In our New England Journal article, we, the last figure, we put some kind of ideas on how physicians might help patients who are interested in switching to intermittent fasting eating pattern accomplish that. And it's based on a lot of human studies in which I was involved in some, but many others, which pretty much uniformly show that it takes people 2 to 4 weeks to adapt to the new eating pattern. So they're no longer hungry and irritable during the time period that they would have previously been eating. And it's exactly as you described, Jed. You know, obviously, if you've been eating breakfast your whole life and stop eating or don't eat breakfast one day, you're going to be very hungry. Your whole physiology is adapted to that eating pattern. And so it just takes not too long, actually, to adapt to the eating pattern. People could ease into it if they want to, you know. If their goal is to narrow the time window they eat each day to, say, 6 to 8 hours, then they can start by just narrowing it to 12 for a couple of weeks, then 10 or whatever. But a lot of people find skipping breakfast easy once they're adapted and find that they're more cognitively sharp and alert in the morning. There's no postprandial sleepiness.
I absolutely agree. Now, let me ask you, Satchi Panda has done a lot of work on circadian eating and, actually suggests that maybe it matters more kind of when you eat in the day, and suggests the opposite of what I think a lot of us do, which is skipping breakfast. He suggests eating, you know, more earlier in the day, and then, you know, maybe skipping dinner. What do you think about that? Is there anything to be said for, you know, if let's say you're going to do 18 hours of fasting a day, does it matter if the 6 hours of eating are from, you know, 6 a.m. to noon or from noon to 6 p.m. or not?
We don't know in humans. The studies haven't been done. Dr. Panda, he done a lot of work in mice where he found that if he restricts the food intake to, say, 8 hours during the dark period, which is the active period for rodents, they're nocturnal, and then has them on a high-fat diet, which would normally cause obesity when they're fed ad libitum, then the animals don't get obese, whereas if he gives them the food in the daytime when they'd normally be sleeping, then they still get obese. But the studies haven't been done in humans yet. From a practical standpoint too, it's not good to eat within a few hours of when you go to sleep, particularly from the standpoint of something like gastric reflux.
Right. Yeah, I certainly find that I sleep better when I don't eat right before bed. And, you know, what I've read is that as recently as, you know, the 50s and 60s, so not that long ago, that, you know, most people were having dinner at, you know, 6 p.m. and then, breakfast at maybe 8:30 a.m. So first of all, people would eat at 6 and then, you know, go to bed at 9 or 10. So there were 3-4 hours between dinner and bedtime, and everybody was fasting 14 hours a day because, you know, 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. So that was just a very different pattern. And now, you know, you wonder if some of the, for example, you know, it seems like everybody these days has reflux, and, you know, if some of this is because we are now with our whatever it may be, crazy work schedules and everything, you know, we're eating at 8 or 9 p.m. and going to bed a half an hour later.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. Now, I mentioned to you before we started recording that I have a wonderful brother who's a MD, PhD scientist. And he said to, we were talking about this, and he said to me, well, you know, I'm not sure that mice are a good surrogate for human nutrition. And he talked about a paper by a scientist named Hu and colleagues, published in Cell Metabolism in 2018, that looked at feeding mice, and you just alluded to this, dietary fat, causing them to develop fat, which, you know, I think we think that's not so true in humans, that that eating fat, so a high fat, low carb diet, maybe is healthier in humans than, and would be less, would produce less fat production than a high carb, low fat diet. So, you know, do we think, I mean, does that call into question whether mice work the same as humans, and whether the kind of animal data in mice is useful when we think about human nutrition?
I think a lot of the data is useful. particularly, so when you talk about nutrition, generally you think of how much a person is eating and what they're eating, and not how often. And so, mice and rats are vegetarians. You know, they're not carnivores or omnivores. So they evolved eating only carbs. And so you put them on a high-fat diet, that could explain, maybe in large part, why they're not able to deal with that and they become fat on high-fat diet, whereas that isn't necessarily true for humans. And so on the other hand, there's been a lot of studies in mice and rats feeding them high-carb diet and showing that caloric restriction and intermittent fasting is beneficial there too. And it seems like the simple sugar intake is a big contributor to a recent epidemic of obesity in humans.
Right. So that's interesting. So, you know, it sounds like the basic evolution of mice has been different in terms of what their diet has been. And so there may be some things like fat versus carbs and the consequences of eating those in mice and humans that are different, but on a cellular level, in terms of kind of what you were talking about when we started, the adaptation to that switching from glucose to ketones and back, that may be something that's kind of more deeply conserved and maybe kind of true across species.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So, in your review, you know, you I think did a really nice job of citing a lot of evidence kind of for the benefits, but then, you know, you kind of at the end of some of the paragraphs, you'd come back and say, you know, there are some counter examples. So for example, you cited a study by Trepanowski and colleagues that didn't show improvement in insulin sensitivity and some other factors with alternate day fasting. So, you know, there are many studies that did, and then, you know, at least this study that did not. Why do you think there's some mixed data? I mean, is it just kind of like study design? Do you feel like it's, you know, pretty safe to say that with at least things like insulin sensitivity, the vast majority of the data would support fasting as beneficial? What do you think is going on with with some of these counterexamples?
Yeah, the counterexample you mentioned, it could be the strain of rat or mice. There may be variability, but I think when we talk about insulin resistance and glucose regulation, we don't have to even consider the animal studies much, because pretty much all the human studies are showing beneficial effects.
Right. I think that's you know, if there's one area from my understanding that's the kind of the most clear cut here in human studies, it's that is the insulin sensitivity and the diabetics. And, you know, Jason Fung, who published The Obesity Code, you know, talks a lot about his work clinically, where he, you know, in his clinic, where he's seeing obese diabetics, and he his kind of number one tool is fasting, and he gets them to fast and reverses their diabetes. He routinely gets them completely non-diabetic. Yep. And so, you know, it's hard in the face of that kind of human data to really, I think, have too much doubt about the efficacy for something like that.
I think, Chad, it won't be long before we'll be able to be more conclusive on the potential ability of intermittent fasting to treat human diseases. There's now at least 20 some that I know of, studies of intermittent fasting in various patient populations. And we put a table in our New England Journal article as a supplement that listed some of the clinical trials in cancers, in inflammatory diseases, several in diabetes, multiple sclerosis. Ellen Mowry who's at Hopkins, has done one pilot study. She's planning another one. So, you know, these are relatively easy studies to do in humans. It's easy to get through the internal review board and, safe for most patient populations.
Right. Yeah, well, that's exciting because we should see a lot more data coming out, as you say. Let me ask, you know, we talk a lot about, and of course it makes sense to think about, and I'm sure these studies are looking at treating human disease, whether that's obesity, diabetes, et cetera, with fasting. Do you think there's any advantage for healthy people to do intermittent fasting? So, you know, again, my brother wrote, I loved his line here. He says, lower blood pressure is good for people with hypertension, but that doesn't mean people with normal blood pressure should take antihypertensives. And so, you know, when we think about obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but they're strongly, I think we can say we strongly believe that, you know, obese diabetics should consider taking, doing some fasting. What about healthy people? Any reason, any data out there or reason to say we should be suggesting to people who are otherwise completely healthy, maybe exercising regularly, et cetera, that they should add to their routine intermittent fasting?
I'll ask you this, Jed. Does your brother exercise?
He does.
Does he have normal blood pressure?
Yeah, he does.
Well, then he doesn't need to exercise. Why is he exercising?
There you go.
I mean, it's the same, exactly the same thing. You know, you can, exercise improves your health. It's really good for your brain, mood, even cognition, in addition to the cardiovascular system. So, again, go to the analogy between exercise and fasting. They're both intermittent fasting. They seem to be both good for general health. There's more and more studies being done and a few published in normal weight, young, healthy people. Those studies have mostly focused on resistance training and showed that healthy people can increase their muscle mass if they're on intermittent fasting just as well as whether they're on their regular eating pattern, and they're able to lose some fat more when they're on intermittent fasting.
Right.
And actually bodybuilders have known this for decades and decades, and they often skip breakfast, do their weightlifting at lunchtime, and then eat in the ensuing 6 to 8 hours.
Right. Well, I love that example of comparing, you know, fasting to exercise. And I think what people might say is, well, I like exercising, right? I go out and play a game of basketball or squash or whatever, and that's enjoyable, whereas fasting would be horrible. And I think, again, that gets to the misunderstanding. I don't do this because I'm diabetic or unhealthy. And, you know, I am lucky to, at the moment in my life, be very healthy and don't need to do it to treat any disease. But I do it because, just like exercise, which, you know, I feel better when I exercise, I feel better when I do intermittent fasting. You mentioned before the kind of clarity of mind in the morning when you're fasted. And I find that absolutely, that, you know, I am very sharp in the morning. I don't get, you know, tired. I don't get it's been a while since I've had breakfast, but I, you know, used to, when I'd eat breakfast, have that kind of postprandial, sleepiness. And, you know, I don't get that at all. You're very sharp. And even longer fasts, you know, I've done 3-4 day fasts, and, you know, you find you don't get particularly sleepy or weak or the things you might think would happen.
Again, going back to your brother, it's so someone who's been sedentary for years and years, and then if they were to go out and try to run 5 miles, they probably wouldn't feel so good at the end of that until they get in shape. You know, so
right.
Yeah, your brother feels good when he exercises regularly, but it took some time for him to get in shape and start feeling good. And so it's, again, similar to intermittent fasting, it takes a while, as I mentioned, 2 to 4 weeks, and then it's, you know, you may, I don't know if you've eaten breakfast much at all, Jed, lately, but you may not feel good if you eat breakfast after you've switched to not.
Right, just like somebody who's used to working out and then stops working out for a week straight would probably feel terrible.
Yeah.
No, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, again, Jason Fung talks in his book, The Obesity Code, talks about how caloric restriction. So people who go on a diet and say, all right, you know, I'm going to cut my calories, you know, pretty severely, but still eat. That's when you get the headaches and the, you know, your body temperature drops and you feel terrible and you feel weak and, you know, you're tired all the time because your body is trying to adjust down so that it doesn't lose weight. It's trying to fight it. It's trying to say, okay, well, fine. If you're going to cut your calories by 500 calories a day, I'm going to cut my body temperature so we burn fewer calories so we match that, right? And so that's when you feel terrible. But fasting, right, your full fast, true fasting, where you're not eating anything, your sympathetic system actually ramps up. It often you feel more energy.
Yeah. That's exactly. Same with exercise, right? You expend a lot of exercise and then you feel like you have more energy.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. But it takes time to get there. But so let me ask you, what is the difference between caloric restriction and intermittent fasting? You know, is there some studies in your review from the New England Journal that look at caloric restriction in mice, for example, versus intermittent fasting? You mentioned that kind of the initial studies looking at caloric restriction kind of ended up inadvertently testing intermittent fasting because they were only feeding the mice, or the mice, when allowed to eat, you know, a certain number of calories, would eat them all within the short window of time. But do we think that fasting is more effective than caloric restriction?
I'll point to two studies, one that we published in PNAS in 2003, where we found that in a certain strain of mice, when we put them on alternate day fasting feeding schedule, the mice on the days they do have food eat essentially twice as much food as they would normally eat, and therefore over time they're not calorie restricted.
Right.
And yet we found that in those mice on intermittent fasting with no caloric restriction, they had improvements in glucose regulation, and then we found that neurons in their brain were more resistant to epileptic seizure-induced damage. And then, as far as human studies, we collaborated with Michelle Harvey in England. Two fairly big studies, 100 women in each study, overweight women. And in each study, they were randomly assigned to either what's now called 5-2 intermittent fasting approach, where 2 days a week they eat only about 600 calories, the other 5 days eat normally. Then the other group, we had them eat three meals a day spaced out, but each meal had about 20 to 25% fewer calories than their estimated daily calorie intake for each person. And these were 6 month studies. The only difference between the two studies was that in the second study, on the 2 days that they were eating only 600 calories, they were eating essentially no carbs, so that then they won't feel as hungry, at least when they first start. So then, anyway, at the end of the 6 months, both groups of women lost about the same amount of weight. But the women on the intermittent fasting eating schedule, they lost more abdominal fat and had greater improvements in insulin sensitivity than did the women who were calorie restricted. So the women who had the metabolic switch occurring 2 days a week had improvements that were better than the women who had reduced calories, but maybe little or no metabolic switching because they spaced the meals out.
Yeah. And, you know, so that I think speaks, as you say, to the fact that it's probably, even with the same amount of calories, the fasting itself has a benefit. And then similarly, you know, the question does come up, is it the weight loss? Because often when you fast, you will lose weight, or when you do intermittent fasting, people will often lose weight. Is it the weight loss or the fasting that's beneficial? But as you said, in the study you just talked about, both groups lost the same amount of weight, but there were more benefits to the fasting group. So there must be something about fasting separate from weight loss that's beneficial.
Yeah, that's right.
So when people are doing this, some people are actually, you know, getting these little finger stick testers, and they're testing their ketones. Is there a, you know, do we know, is there a certain level needed to get the benefits? Is any ketosis enough? Is there any reason to think that, you know, longer fasts are better? Anything like that?
Well, it's interesting. There have been studies where blood has been taken at different time points up to several days after the initiation of fasting. And what's seen is that during the first 12 and 24 hours, there's a increase from essentially undetectable levels to about 0.2 to 0.5 millimolar. And then after 24 hours, for example, 48 hours, the ketones have gone up into the approximately 2 millimolar level. So all I can say is that improvements in risk factors for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, stroke occur with even these smaller time windows where there's this small, it's actually not small because you're coming from undetectable up to 0.2 to 0.5 millimolar range is sufficient. Whether the question of longer fast, it gets a little complicated because first there haven't been many studies done, and the studies usually have been done with longer fast, say a week. 2 weeks is the subjects of just do it once a year, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been published studies where they do measurements before they start the fasting, you know, glucose, insulin, blood pressure, et cetera. And then at the end of the week or 2 weeks of fasting, and they show improvements. But then I've talked to these scientists who've done these studies. They don't really have data, you know, following these people. You know, are those apparent short-term benefits, how long do they last?
Right.
In animals, anyway, we've done studies where we put animals on alternate day fasting, monitor their heart rate and blood pressure. Resting heart rate and blood pressure go down within about 2 weeks, and then more so by a month, and then they stay down for at least another few months. We take them off of intermittent fasting, so they're back where they always have food. And within 2 weeks, the heart rate and blood pressure are back to where they were. So I think these, it's better long term to, just like exercise. If you stop exercising, it doesn't take long before you get out of shape.
Right. So we don't really know if, you know, a long fast once a year is equivalent to, always doing an 18-6. What about, you know, so there's a variety of approaches. You mentioned the 5-2. There's the 18-6 where people only eat within a 6-hour window. There's the OMAD, one meal a day, OMAD, where people only eat one meal a day. So they're going 24 hours every day. There is, of course, people doing longer fasts once a year, once a quarter, or, you know, et cetera. Do we know anything about the kind of relative benefits from one regimen to another?
There have been no head-to-head comparisons. not only in humans, but really not in rodents. It turns out investigators, they kind of settle on one intermittent fasting regimen, and then they don't want to change it because they're kind of expanding upon the initial studies and the initial data.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, we,
okay.
There's no
so we don't
comparisons.
Yep. Yeah. Fair enough. Now, what about when people are fasting? You know, I think, and tell me if I'm wrong, that most people during their fasting periods, whatever regimen they're doing, are still drinking water or, you know, black coffee, tea without any, you know, sugar in it, you know, regular tea. That's fine, right? That doesn't affect your development of ketosis.
That's right.
Is there any, you know, thought, has anyone looked at fasting with or without liquid? I mean, is a full fast with, I mean, I have not done it to fast without any intake of any liquid. I would think you'd get into trouble with dehydration, but is that, do we know anything about whether that's beneficial or not?
There's no data I know that suggests that not taking in fluids during the fasting period is beneficial. And I wouldn't recommend it. So I think it's important for people to stay hydrated.
Right. Totally. And that's my thought too. And I'm glad to know there's no reason pushing me to try to do it without water. Now, what about electrolytes? If people are fasting, you know, you read a lot, kind of colloquially, there's a lot online. If you look at the various fasting, you know, websites, and people will say, you know, you really need to supplement sodium, magnesium, potassium. Is that true? Should people be taking supplements during their fasting periods?
No, they don't need to.
No, your body will.
Yeah, yeah. Again, go back to the evolutionary perspective, right? It's particularly these very short fasts, you know, whatever, 18 hours a day or a couple days a week, eating only one meal, it's not an issue. We're designed to. Our electrolytes aren't going to get out of whack that quickly.
Right. So as long as you have healthy kidneys and, you know, you don't have any otherwise electrolyte abnormalities or ability to handle, you know, your body can handle it normally, you should be fine fasting. And that, as you said, that makes sense, right? Nobody back when we were hunter-gatherers and were, you know, in a particularly lean time was supplementing with sodium pills. So, you know, now it's possible that the water back then had more electrolytes and it certainly wasn't being filtered and cleaned. But I think you're right that you probably don't for short fasts and for longer fasts. I mean, you know, again, I keep referring to Jason Fung, but, you know, he talks about having people doing 30, 40, 50 day fasts, you know, if they're, you know, 400 pounds with severe diabetes and, you know, need very little, if any, electrolyte supplementation, even that long. So you'd imagine that, you know, you probably are fine for even 2, 3, 4 days without it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Are there subsets of people who should not fast, even for these short intermittent types? For example, maybe patients with type 1 diabetes, anyone you'd say, you know, look, probably better not to do this or no?
I would say perhaps elderly people who are with really low BMI, or certainly if they're becoming frail, children, at least little children. Although there is some interest in, there's increase in childhood and adolescent obesity, so there's some interest in you know, might the switching eating patterns for these kids you know, help them keep their weight down. Yeah, type 1 diabetes. There's at least one published study where they, you know, they carefully monitored the insulin dependent patients and were able to get them to switch to an intermittent fasting eating pattern. It's just a matter of getting the insulin level right.
Right.
So, but I think, you know, for anyone listening who has type 1 diabetes, I wouldn't suggest they try this at this point. Yeah,
that sounds reasonable. Let me ask you about this subset. So we talked about how when you fast, you can actually get an increased sympathetic tone. So do you think that would be potentially a problem for people with coronary artery disease?
Well, actually, you get increased parasympathetic tone.
Oh, over the long term.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
We've shown that clearly in rats and mice. It's also been shown in humans by Luigi Fontana at WashU.
Right. No, I totally agree with that. I was thinking more during the fast. So, for example, you know, if you're doing a 2 or 3 day fast, you often, you know, we talked about how in the morning you may have, you know, I think there's some studies showing increased norepinephrine, for example, when you're when you are not eating. Is there any reason to think that, you know, that increased norepinephrine level might be harmful to people with coronary artery disease in terms of, you know, heart rate, et cetera, or not?
I don't know of any data that would address that question.
Okay. And I can tell you that although I feel more awake when fasted in the morning, I don't think I'm tachycardic. So I think probably that's not a factor. But one thing that people do talk about, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this or know of any studies looking at this, is that when fasting, people, again, not really for the 18 hours, but, you know, after when they get into the longer 2 to 3 days and more, sometimes can have trouble sleeping. I think, again, because that sympathetic discharge makes it a little hard to sleep. And again, if we think evolutionarily, it makes sense. If you were fasting, you'd want to be running after a deer to try to get some food, not, you know, not sleeping all day. So do you ever have thoughts on
that? I don't know about these longer fasts, but the short daily fasting periods or 2 days a week, eating only one meal, essentially, I'm not aware of sleeping problems.
Yeah, and, I think you're right.
And also, Jed, getting back to a comment you made earlier about circadian rhythms and thinking about sleep. I don't know if you go to sleep and you haven't eaten for, say, whatever, 8-10 hours, I don't know. You know, that may make it harder, although you may adjust. Any of these things, maybe you can get adapted to over time.
Right. And I completely agree with you. I actually don't think that with these shorter fasts, even 24 hours, that I have noticed any trouble sleeping. It's only when you get into a little bit longer. And it's not that it's impossible to sleep, but it's just interesting that sometimes you can feel a little bit more awake at night, even when you haven't eaten for a few days. So let's move to the perioperative arena. So, you know, some studies like the one from Mitchell and colleagues from 2013 that you mentioned in your article show improved outcomes with pre-op fasting. But then, of course, our current movement in the perioperative arena is really toward more and more of these ERAS pathways, that's early recovery after surgery, that call for, you know, patients taking a drink of carbohydrates, you know, 30 cc's of a carb-rich drink right up to, you know, an hour or two before surgery, which obviously seems to be the opposite of fasting before surgery. Is there, you know, and why do we, how do we reconcile that? Do you think there's, and I'm sure we need to do more work on this, but do you think that fasting before surgery is advantageous or not, or maybe we're looking at two different things?
Well, my educated guess on this question would be that if the surgery is elective and, you know, it can be scheduled, say, a month down the road, then my guess would be that if the person gets adapted to intermittent fasting before the surgery, it would be beneficial. Because we see some of these preconditioning-like effects where there's increased cellular stress resistance. And then once they're adapted, then in the recovery period, you'd have this switching back and forth between the stress resistance and growth and repair modes. However, you know, if there's someone that's not adapted to intermittent fasting, and then you just, do a fast perioperatively, that may not have any beneficial effects. So, you know, there's some inflammation associated with eating. It turns out every time you eat a meal, and McDonald's type food, more so than healthy food, but anyway, there's actually an increase in circulating pro-inflammatory cytokines that occurs acutely. So it's particularly so with sugars, and there's some data all to Luigi Ferrucci, who is at National Institute on Aging, did a study that indicates with essentially you had to eat like Big Mac and fries, and that also, now these aren't huge increases, but they're statistically significant. So, you know, and then there's this whole issue about whether inflammation, well, there's inflammation has both good and bad aspects in relation to tissue injury. Some inflammation is good, at least acutely, but chronically not so good. So,
right.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you know, to the best that we can kind of guess right now, it's not that an acute fast, especially not in someone not accustomed to it, right before surgery is beneficial, but that being having this intermittent fasting and accustomizing your body to it leading up to surgery might help with outcomes after surgery, because your body now has had, as you say, kind of a preconditioning, and then we'll be able to handle the stresses of the recovery period better.
Yes.
Okay. And then are there other considerations in the perioperative arena that we have any information on postoperatively, for example? I mean, we, again, you cite some benefits in animals with spinal cord injury when they fast after the injury in reducing damage and improving outcomes. Is there any reason to think that, because we're, again, with the ERAS movement, we're really pushing patients to eat as quickly as possible after surgery. Is there any reason to think that fasting after a surgical injury may be beneficial in terms of anything like wound healing, recovery, et cetera?
I think it would be good here to talk about ischemic tissue injury. We're involved in studies in animal models of stroke and myocardial infarction, where we found really quite dramatic tissue sparing effects of intermittent fasting if the occlusion of the artery in the brain or the coronary artery was done after the animals had been adapted to the every other day fasting for, well, we just did a couple months, but there has been some interest in post-stroke intermittent fasting. There's one animal study showing improved recovery following stroke with intermittent fasting. I had a colleague down at in Fairfax at Nova?
Inova.
Yeah. He was the head of their neuroscience and neurology, and he was gearing up to do a trial, but then a kind of intermittent fasting post stroke, but he hasn't got around to it. There's problems in humans with these trials in stroke, or particularly stroke, maybe, I don't know, tissue injury. There's so much variability between individuals in terms of, in the case of these ischemic insults, you know, which artery is affected, you know, how long is it blocked with the clot before there's reperfusion, et cetera, and then the metabolic state, probably genetic factors we don't understand. And you know, it would make sense that may be similar to traumatic tissue injury, whether through accident or through a surgeon's scalpel. there's a lot of variability probably between patients, and it's the clinical trials are, you've got to have really good inclusion, exclusion criteria and endpoints that are most likely to yield a significant result.
Right. Well, so it sounds like we'll be getting more information. I mean, there's reason to think, and this does sound so much like ischemic preconditioning, that maybe being accustomed to having exposure to the stress of intermittent fasting may help post-surgery, post-MI, post-stroke, but kind of more data to come on that.
Yep.
Great. Well, Mark, this has been just fascinating, and I've loved having this conversation. But let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. So I'll ask you, anything to recommend that our audience check out when they have time?
Well, I'd suggest, it's been a few years ago, but I gave a TED Talk. It's easy to find. You just Google my name and TED, and I guess fasting. And so on the internet, it's actually hard to find the real clear information. So I think your listeners should maybe focus on recent review articles that they find on PubMed, rather than right now, if you Google intermittent fasting, the first, I don't know how many pages are just these random people who are, I guess they're trying to make money or something. I don't know how. You shouldn't make money on intermittent fasting, but anyway, they have their own little angle on it.
Exactly. But the real data is available, obviously, in scientific studies. And then is that what your TED Talk is on, kind of the data behind intermittent fasting?
Yeah. And it's focused on the brain, and it has in there historical perspective from going back to Roman times when back then, if someone was having epileptic seizures, they were thought to be possessed by demons. And I guess just empirically by trial and error, they found if they locked these demon-possessed individuals in a room for several days, the demons would go away. And scientifically, probably what's happening is their ketones going up because they didn't feed them when they locked them in the room.
Right.
And ketones are very good at suppressing epileptic seizure. In fact, ketogenic diets are still prescribed in some cases, people with epilepsy. So anyway, it's got historical perspective, but also basic science. But I kind of made it, it's a TED Talk, so it's got to be, have a lot of angles on it.
That's great. Well, I will check that out for sure and recommend folks do. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. My random recommendation, completely unrelated to anything we've been talking about, and I can't remember if I've already recommended this or not. So listeners, if I already did this, I apologize for repeating myself. But Monopoly Deal is a game someone recommended to me. My wife and I got it. It is, if you like Monopoly, but you don't want to spend, you know, 1, 2, 3 hours playing a Monopoly game, this is a card game version of Monopoly that takes about 15 minutes to play. It's a lot of fun. It's doable with kids, so I can play with my 7 and 8 year old, but also my wife and I can play just the two of us and have fun, and you can play with 2, 3, or 4 people. So it's very flexible. It's short, which is really key, obviously, for those of us with busy lives, and a ton of fun. So I'm not receiving any money from whoever makes Monopoly Deal, but I do like the game and recommend people check it out. All right. Well, Mark, thank you so much for taking so much time to come on the show. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to seeing you around Hopkins.
Okay, Jed, I enjoyed our conversation, and I hope your readers will find something in there that of interest.
I'm sure they will. Thanks.
All right.
All right. That was really fascinating. I certainly found it to be, and I certainly hope all of you did too. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say as well. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Jay Wolpaw, and we, the podcast, are at ACRAC Podcast. And of course, we have an ACRAC Facebook group you can check out as well. If you're a fan of the show and you haven't already, or even if you have but not in a little while, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you are interested in supporting the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also, of course, make a donation anytime at paypal.me/acrac. Huge thanks to those who are already patrons and have already made donations, and we really appreciate it. Big thanks to our intern, Kimmy Akash Cooley, to Dr. Brian Park, and to April Liu for their fantastic work on the outlines for some of the episodes. And, of course, thank you to Dr. Dennis Kuo, who composed the original ACRAC music. You can see his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Mark Madsen, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.